This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
As kids, we were told it's not polite to talk about religion, sex, or politics at the dinner table. But at the open table, nothing is off limits.
Hello, hello, hello. This is The Open Table. I'm Craig Brown. I'm your host as the beautiful music of Cub Sport just plays over in the background there. And I'm joined, as usual, by a man who could only be described as long-suffering or lacking discernment. Ethan Kyoto Hall, welcome.
Still here, again. Another week.
Still here.
Another week.
Another week. And things don't change.
Another mistake.
What, how's your week been?
Pretty good. School just started back, so a little tiring getting back into that groove.
And we're going to touch on a range of topics today. If you've missed some of the previous episodes on the show, you can listen to us wherever you get your podcasts from, or you can go to joy.org.au/theopentable. And of course, we're coming to you from the lands of the traditional custodians of the Kulin Nations here in St Kilda. We would pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and to our rainbow mob. If you're new to The Open Table, pull up a chair. It's great to have you here with us tonight. The Open Table is about, it's about making time to have important conversations about topics that maybe we don't often talk about. So we want people to come on the show to feel free to tell their stories, maybe about religion, about sex, politics, health, art, maybe all of those things in one show. That would be, we'd have to play bingo, I think. You know, topic bingo and whatever else might come up. Today's guest is model, disability advocate, ambassador for the push-up challenge, the very photogenuous James Parr. Welcome, James.
Hello, thank you. I wouldn't say photogenuous. I'm here on radio now.
So. Yes, that's right. And I would mostly say photogenic, but that was just me stumbling across my words. So
as I started saying it, I was wait, what am I even saying?
That's not right, is it? It was a cross between photogenic and disingenuous or something. So it was a little bit of a backhanded insult as well.
I went along with it. So I can blame myself as much as I can blame
That's
you.
That's right. You were warned. You were warned before you came on the show. It is great to have you here. How has your week been?
My week's been like a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It's been like a bit intense. It's been, freeing and fun. And
that's good. So, James, I listed some of the things you do. What would you say you do?
Depends who's asking me, but I would always just go, I'm a model, disability advocate. Probably just those two things, but I'm an event host, I'm a speaker, I'm a writer.
Ah, what do you write?
Freelance articles for fashion brands.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I myself am a writer.
Oh, yeah.
So, if we go by the Midnight in Paris view of writers that we now have to battle to see who is the better writer in the room. But I'm going to let that go today.
It's new for me in the last 2 years. So it's been an interesting challenge.
Oh, that's great.
Did study teaching and work in education for majority, maybe 8 years.
Yep.
So I just use what I know from there.
That's brilliant. Brilliant. What's your cultural religious background?
So I'm also Aboriginal, I'm Mob Wiradjuri, and I grew up with a Catholic family, mainly my nan, and not my biological nan either, but she would take me to Sunday school and stuff like that, but I didn't really have an interest.
It didn't stick.
No.
Tell me about Wiradjuri country.
It's one of the largest countries, and so I grew up in Deniliquin, and our mob was from Hay.
Oh, okay.
Just down the road, essentially,
Right. And
very beautiful.
Yeah. What brought you to Melbourne?
Work. So I was working in schools. I think my last role was maybe I was a welfare officer on wellbeing. And then that's really when, modelling career fell into my lap, and it sort of started building from there. And in that moment, I was I may as well just come to Melbourne for 6 months and see what happens. And it became my full-time job.
And it stuck.
Yeah.
That stuck.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
Very weird contrast between the two jobs.
Yes. And where do you identify on the queer spectrum?
Bisexual.
Yep.
Yeah. Queer. I don't know.
Yeah.
No. I think I would usually just go bisexual, yeah. But I tried queer.
Like, you tried queer?
I'm like queer, but I'm like, it didn't sound right. Yeah, so okay. I just like stick to bisexual. Yeah.
I think if I can recall accurately, I think we've had actually the bulk of our guests, not the bulk, but probably the largest group of our guests would have gone by the label bisexual on the show so far.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really interesting.
That's good.
Yeah, because it's kind of
okay,
often,
bisexual awareness.
Yeah, because it's often, tell me if I'm wrong, an overlooked.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And very misjudged as well, or also like devalued maybe, as it's like not a real thing.
What one misconception about bisexuality would you like to clear up if you had the chance?
Ooh.
Like now?
Do you know what? I think none, because it's going to give you another misconception. Okay. So I think do with that what you will.
Ooh, mystery, and mystique.
Yeah, yeah, and I think have an open mind and use that open mind to define it yourself.
Yeah. So when did you come to the realization that you weren't straight?
Maybe like when I was 5 years old, walking around the farm.
Yeah.
I had a really bad lisp.
Yep.
And I would sing Shania Twain and be like, let's go, girls.
Yeah.
But like really bad. Maybe that's when my family realized, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, I think around 20, in school, I had a girlfriend for like 2.5 years.
Yep.
And then I think during that time when I was a teenager, I was like too into girls that I didn't really think about it or look at it until I think just like after we broke up. Yeah.
Yeah. And so your teenage years would have been in around Deniliquin, Hay.
I was in Cobram.
Cobram,
so
okay.
So like also country.
Yep.
Just like finding gold if you're gay in a country town or like queer or anything really.
Yeah. The only gay in the village.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which everyone would always ask if I was, and I was just like, oh no. Because I wasn't at the time.
Yeah.
I hadn't really found it. Yeah. But.
And when did you, around 20 you came to the realization, was it?
Or? Yeah. I feel like I also was aware that I had an attraction to men when I was a teenager. But in that, I didn't really realize that it was like a sexual attraction, I guess. And then after me and my girlfriend broke up, I just started looking at men differently, I guess.
Mm. It's a great realization when you realize that, there's something different about looking at a man with those eyes. With that
No, it is. Because before I was just like, oh yeah, like, dude, great, they're good looking.
And was there a first kiss that sort of cemented that for you that you can tell us about?
Oh,
or willing to tell us about?
Like a man or my very first kiss?
Oh, which one do you want to tell us about?
Oh, well, I actually can't even think about my first kiss with a man. I don't know who, what, when, where, why, how.
Just,
I remember my first time kissing a girl. I was like 14. I just like was dating like this girl from school.
Yeah.
And she came over one day. And mind you, her family were like dairy farmers. And so I think she was like milking cows and stuff in the afternoon.
Yes. But so you lured her away from udders.
Yeah. And she smelt like cow poo. And we just thought it was like a good idea for us to like both have our first kiss together.
Romantic.
And I remember walking away thinking, wow, that was not pleasant. I don't think the cow poo should be like, that shouldn't have been part of that experience.
No,
and that's what made it not pleasant.
The aroma of manure. Ethan, your thoughts on the aroma of manure as a romantic sort of aphrodisiac?
I mean, I have heard it does it for some people.
I'm not some people. Let me make that clear.
No. And we're not going to kink shame anyone on this show.
No.
But
I'm just clarifying.
You just clarify. No, absolutely. You're allowed to do that. Hey, speaking of girls that you may have had a crush on, we've got a song coming up from Ariana Grande. Yes.
Love of my life.
I believe that you may have met Ariana.
Yeah, at the Wicked premiere.
What were you wearing?
Oh, it's actually embarrassing.
No.
I did it as a joke.
Yeah.
I need to preface that.
Yeah.
I didn't think I would follow through with it, but I got Glinda. So I got my prosthetist to put Glinda on my prosthetic leg.
See, I think that's amazing. That's not
It's great.
Yeah.
It's funny.
That's just taking it to another level.
Watching Wicked with Ariana Grande sitting behind me. Like, I still can't believe that happened. I didn't even watch the movie.
You're just basking.
But like every second I'd be, oh, what's Ariana doing? Like,
probably watching the movie.
So I just kept looking back.
Yeah.
So I couldn't stop.
That's lovely. Now, 21, something fairly significant. happened to you, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I was diagnosed with a rare bone cancer in my right ankle, osteosarcoma. Yeah, I had like chemo, and then that didn't really do anything, actually.
Oh, really?
It sort of just like aggravated the cancer from like what was going to be a bone graft to, and resulting in an amputation of, it's below knee amputation. And then just had like 6 more months of chemo.
That is a thing to deal with at any age. How did you process that?
Yeah, look.
Sorry, starting just even from the diagnosis.
Thinking back, it just feels like a past life. Like that didn't ever really happen. It was sort of like a flash. I think really that comes from a place of like acceptance. And I think in my life then, because I had such like a rough childhood and I was constantly like in survival mode, at that age, I sort of had still done everything I wanted to do. I was in the job that I loved. I was living where I loved. And I loved everything about my life, but I just didn't feel fulfilled. And I was sort of just starting to like become unmotivated because I just felt bored.
Yeah.
So I think that happened around that time, exactly where I was feeling stuck and like looking at what to do next. So I think for me, it actually just made sense. And I think it sort of just came from a place of acceptance of knowing that that was my path.
That's a remarkable response. When you first heard, and I assume that's when the chemo all would have started, of course. What was the sense from the doctors? We were just going to do chemo, you should be okay, or?
Look, it was a misdiagnosis for 10 months. So they treated the first diagnosis, and that's when they figured out it was cancer. And then they called me the week after. And so I was still in pain. So look, I think that week I sort of just subconsciously knew that it was cancer. Mm. So when he told me, he told me over the phone and I didn't really realize what he had said. I was like, wait, is that actual cancer?
Oh, okay.
Because it was a very brief conversation.
Yeah, so you weren't in the room.
No, no. I went to see him the week after. Yeah. And when he said osteoid, I was like, yeah, okay. And then after, I was like, wait, did he say that was cancer? So I had to Google it, which was also the worst thing to do. So it tells you amputation.
Goodness. Yes, yes.
But like in that, which is not a worst thing, but I think for a moment, I had just like a sense of like not actually knowing until I went and saw him. But I think subconsciously, I had sort of already accepted it. Look, there was like fear unknown. My mum died of cancer.
Okay.
So nothing linked. So I think it was like fear of the unknown on that.
Yeah.
Also an acceptance of knowing that I was going to be my path. But I think initially it was just like a bone graft. So it was like the first 3 months that the cancer cells ended up spreading around the whole ankle.
And then the...
the chemo started like literally a week after.
Yep.
The way that they deal with the cancer, because it's so rare, is that they start you off on chemo just to try and like control it and stop the cells moving around your body. And then they go back and look at the surgical options.
Okay. So how did you start to process the thought of losing your leg below your knee?
I guess I had accepted it and understood it and I felt okay. I think the hard thing around me was that, and like to be honest, it was a very chill process. I remember in the appointment, like my nan was crying when the surgeon said amputation. There was another choice, but that one didn't make sense. And I was like, yeah, whatever. Like I'll sign the permission slip
yes.
you have to do for surgery.
Yes.
I was like, I'll sign it now. And the surgeon was like, are you sure? I'm like, why not? Like, what am I waiting for?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it happened a week after. That was a weird thing.
That's
I was
quick.
Like, when will it happen?
Yeah.
It was like, next week. I'm like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Could give me some more like time with this leg.
But I've become attached to this leg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Honestly.
And so, up in the week after, and I had the surgery done on a Tuesday. You wake up with an epidural, which freaked me out. And I got all the pain meds turned off on Friday.
Okay.
And I've never had pain since. So for me, the whole process was pretty chill. The chemo was like the roughest part. But I think I had accepted it, but it was just the way that people started to interact with me and the way it shifted, which really opened my eyes to the way people perceived disability and kept constantly telling me they were sad for me. And like, which... understand, but also is really hard to hear someone that they feel sad for you because it's like, do you know what you just said without thinking about it? And
yes, that your situation is something that I can only express sadness about.
Yeah. And that was especially afterwards, just because I would see the prosthetic leg.
Yep.
And I'm like, I actually love my life. I get free, like, disabled parking. So, like, you should not feel sad for me. That is a highlight of my life. I'm kidding.
No,
it did cost a leg, but, like, you know.
Not an arm and a leg, but just a leg.
It was half price.
Half price. Yeah. Yeah, discount.
Yeah.
And you would have got a good park outside of the building here.
Oh, actually, like, I walked.
Oh, you walked, so you didn't need to worry about that.
No.
What's the process there? Sorry.
Yeah, okay, interesting process. Yeah. So, you have the amputation, and then the day after, actually, a prosthetist comes in, and he casts your leg, because then they put a plaster over it.
Yeah.
Just to control the swelling. It was actually, like, as big as my head. That's how swollen it was. And so to control the swelling, and also just so as your brain starts to get used to something being on it, because you're going to then sit in a prosthetic. And then once they clear, they take the stitches out. That's when you can go into a prosthetic. And because I was living in the country at the time, I did inpatient rehab. And I actually didn't do rehab. I was chill to walk.
You didn't do rehab?
No. The only thing that they made me do, because I was like, I don't need it. I would like get up in the morning and put it straight on and go for a walk and
chill.
That's
it.
Yeah.
That's it.
But the only thing that they made me do every day was play Wii Fit at 2 p.m.
Okay, yes.
Which I hated at the start because I was like, I'm not doing that. But I actually low-key loved it because when I did do it, respectfully, the room was filled of old people.
Oh, you just...
And it was just like this silly guy with one leg beating them all. And that was the highlight.
It's That's always good for your self-esteem there.
Yeah, I was like, you have two legs, huh? Like, watch me.
And you hadn't had one leg for long.
No.
And you just adapted. Yeah. You seem to be remarkably, and you've used the word a few times, chill.
Yeah.
About the process.
Yeah, I think it's like, just like the acceptance of those events. I guess growing up, I already had like a pretty tough childhood that I was already very resilient. And... yeah, I think it's just like adapting from that.
You mentioned a couple of times that you had a kind of a rough childhood that built in the resilience that obviously kicked in when you had your cancer diagnosis. Do you want to touch on that a little bit for us?
Yeah. Look, my mum died when I was 8. Yep. She had cancer. And then my dad and her were together at the time. But after my mum died, he remarried and had 2 new kids. And... I think I was like 13. I ran away just because it wasn't a safe place. And yeah, I went and lived with his sister, my auntie. And yeah, that was like my family from then. But it also was not a dissimilar situation.
Okay.
It was different in different ways. That pretty much was like my whole childhood, which was pretty intense. I was constantly just like living in survival mode.
Yeah.
But
what is survival mode feel like over that sort of length of time?
Normal?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Okay, yeah. Good answer.
It does. Because I'm very self-aware that I can feel myself if I am going back into like a survival mode sort of type. I guess survival mode is just whatever you can do to like get through the day. You know, there were times, and I still do it now sometimes, like in maybe like a little bit of confrontation, I will just shut down.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't say anything when I was younger, so I do shut down sometimes in those situations.
Have you had to learn how to deal with conflict or?
Yes, I have. And so a part of that is when I was working in schools, I was working with children who come from trauma or had a disability. And so in that, I studied child development and trauma and adolescent. So in studying that, it actually opened my eyes up a lot to things about myself that I understood more on a deeper level.
Mm.
And so I think that combining with, well, using that to relearn, I think was really how I learned. And when it comes to like conflict, I think it's really just like removing the emotion out of it and just like looking at it in a different way. Whereas if I do like maybe shut down or if I am responding back in emotion, I'll just have a break and communicate that as well in a healthy way.
Yeah. It sounds like you've learned how to be really in touch with how you're feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is an extraordinary amount of resilience to have built up, which obviously once the cancer diagnosis came in, was that survival mode then? Was that just, I've just got to do what I have to do?
Ooh. Yeah, I don't know. Look, I think in that was also just understanding that, like, as a human vessel, we're constantly learning and making sense of the world. Mm. And every interaction that we do or every experience that we have, we just use to, like, our schema and what we can take away from it into the next situation.
Yeah.
And I think that also comes to that. And I was like, this might be fun. This might be the worst time of my life. I don't know. But it will also contribute and shape who I am. And I know I'll be able to look back on that at some time.
Do you think it's given you a superpower? The stuff that you've gone through?
Like, no.
No. So you can't fly.
Nah.
Obviously.
I don't know if it's a superpower, but I think it's just like understanding. And I think we all have, like, life is challenging.
Yeah.
I think it's just being able to control what I can control in those moments.
Speaking of things that you can control, probably about a month ago, we had the wonderful Clint Dowdell on the show talking about the stigma that he's experienced as a HIV positive man. And he talked about the fact that he had to experience both the stigma that's been put on him by others, but also the big one that he had was battling the internal one, which is the one he could control. Obviously, you wear a prosthetic. Do you feel like you've had to experience stigma both externally and internally?
Yeah. I think the external stigma was what made me really question my own internal.
Yeah.
Because I think even at the start, I was like, I'm not disabled, but I am. And that made me challenge myself. And it was also interesting because I worked in special ed for about 4 years.
Yeah.
So even being able to reflect on that as well made me challenge myself. I think it was just like redefining it, but also learning that when I did challenge myself, it really just came down to the perception of media.
Mm.
That's where we're taught. Look at a TAC ad. There's a car accident.
Yes.
Which is so realistic. But at the end, it's someone like using a wheelchair. And the way that's portrayed is like it's the worst thing that could happen to you. Yeah. So I think really starts to like form your perception of things as well. And I think understanding that and being able to be in a position where I could use a voice or try and do as much as I can to help shift that narrative, I think it's really important to try and rewrite the narrative that disability has.
That label, I have an issue with labels. I don't like how we will sometimes just boil people down to one thing. Do you get the label disabled thrown at you a lot, and how do you respond to that when it happens?
Well, yeah, I do, but I also am. So I'm like,
you sort of own it.
Yeah, because I'm like, I just sort of think, well, if I'm going to have an issue with it, that's playing into the misconception, which is challenging, but it's also very true. And I think disability means so many different things, and I think it's just taking control back of that narrative. And
because there's a power in owning it, isn't there?
100%. Yeah. And what was I saying? Back to the stigma.
Mm.
And I love this though. I'll be like walking the street in pants. No one's ever waiting, letting me cross the road. The next day I'm in shorts. Everyone lets me cross the road. I never have to wait.
There you go.
So I'm like, thanks for that stigma. I will play into that.
Stigma gets me places quicker.
100%.
100%. The other thing is like gay culture in particular. And I know you're bisexual, but obviously, when you're dating men, gay culture can be a little bit, it can be a bit superficial. I mean, that might be a shock to some people out there.
It's so shocking.
It's so shocking. But, I mean, I've also, and I'm now prefacing my own question, which is just so self-absorbed. But also, gay culture can be very accepting. So, has that been a challenge for you that people might have an inbuilt stigma about somebody who's not their ideal?
So, do you know what? I haven't had it for years that cool. I can't even say, like, I would love say yes.
But well, it would be drama.
Yeah, no.
Did you make something up?
No.
No, okay. Nah, that's fine.
But, like, I just remember at the start, maybe there was someone that blocked me.
Yeah.
And then nothing ever's really happened after that, except for just where people will ask what happened to my leg and I'll make up a stupid story.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the first question is what happened to your leg? So I'm like,
that's
boring.
It's a great first date, isn't
it? Yeah. Well, that's like their first message on the dating app sometimes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's when I'll like make up a story and just like really mess with them because it's sort of entertaining.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't had it for years. I remember the first time after the amputation, I had the prosthetic. I was wearing pants. Me and my friend went to circuit.
Yeah.
And I ended up going home with someone.
So you're wearing pants at circuit?
Yeah, wearing pants. And we're walking home and it just hit me. I'm like, oh, this man does not know I have one leg. Wow, I can't like take my pants off and take a limb off as well. I need to tell them. And I was like, how do I tell them without laughing? Because no one's... this man ain't going to believe me. And he was just like, wow. Because he was just like shocked that he just was like, oh, didn't even notice. But yeah, even that wasn't...
I think it says a lot for your sense of acceptance that it's not something that you're explaining constantly.
No, but I think if people... there was a stigma attached to it... Mm. And people asked in a respectful, appropriate setting to ask a question, 100%. But there are times like where people are just, you know, but you can sort of filter through that. But I think people need to know these things.
Yeah. Education.
So I don't really mind, but I did have, and I haven't heard it for years. It's like when people will like tell me that they feel sad or sorry for me, I'll just be like, what for?
Yeah.
And they don't have an answer. I'm like, there's your answer.
God, I mean, this is on radio, but you're a strapping, tall individual. Nothing really to feel sorry about for you from that perspective.
Sure, thanks. Yeah. But I think it's also just like having an opinion of me or my life just based off a visual thing.
Yeah.
So it's like...
yeah. And there's more to us than what meets the eye. James, you're the ambassador. Or a ambassador for the push-up challenge. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the push-up challenge is in June.
Yep.
And it's really just like a social movement and way to raise money for the push-up challenge to give back to men's mental health.
And one of my sons did it last year.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
How'd it go?
He did very well. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing 3,214 push-ups across, I think it's 23 days.
And it sounds like a lot.
Yeah, it does, but it also is.
don't downplay it, Craig. Yeah, it is a lot.
No, it is, I guess.
Yeah.
That's why it's the challenge.
Yeah.
But yeah, 3,214 represents the number of lives lost to suicide last year as well. So
That's the connection. Okay, yeah.
So it's a really good way also to honor those lives lost. And I think the conversation around mental health is a really important one because I think it's not a conversation a lot of people are having. And a lot of people, I think there's stigma attached to talking about mental health. I try to be as honest and open as I can because I think that's like really healthy and important. We're still getting there. That I know sometimes I'll even think to myself like, oh, people are going to think I'm like attention seeking or something like that. And one, there's actually nothing wrong if you are attention seeking because that's a very human thing to do.
And it's a good thing to seek attention for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And two, talking about it's going to make other people talk about it.
It's that whole thing that we've often used about not being straight and sort of saying to people, you can't be what you can't see. So if people are talking about mental health in a way that is open, that, as you said, that really just encourages other people to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So was this a personal experience for you in terms of wanting to connect with this campaign? Or?
Yeah, I think it means a lot. I've had some people close to me that have lost their lives. But I also think whether you're indirectly or directly affected by mental health, I think it's something that we're all going to experience as well.
Absolutely.
So I think the social change and being able to talk about it and promote it more and recognize it, I think is like the most important thing.
I think the thing that we do much better than, say, when I was growing up back in the 1800s, that there's actually a language around mental health now to talk about it.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I just feel blue. Or But we can actually start to talk about depression, anxiety, et cetera, et cetera.
For sure. And I think it really connects with me as well because I think physical movement was such a big part of my life and really helped me find myself as well when I was at a low point in my mental health.
Yep.
And so I think that also connects to the part of the reason why I'm an ambassador for it. Plus, it's also a really fun challenge to do that amount of push-ups per day.
Yep.
I know when I filmed the TV ad a couple of weeks ago, I do like 3 push-ups on that TV ad. I did 200 that day.
200?
And it took 2 weeks for my, because I hadn't done that amount for a while.
So you weren't doing push-ups before you were shooting the push-up challenge?
No.
No.
Because I just thought I knew in my head that I should have.
Yeah.
But then I also...
Much more authentic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even need fake sweat.
You didn't need fake sweat.
No, I did. I'm kidding.
It's been funny because I've been on certain websites and seeing your face pop up there promoting it.
Oh, the little sweat drip.
Yeah, there's a sweat drip.
Well, I love it. It's great.
It's great. Now I know it's real.
Yes.
Fantastic. And people obviously raise money by getting people to sponsor them.
Yeah, like getting involved with it. If you just Google Push for Better, it'll come up if anyone does want to sign up and challenge themselves.
Yeah, we'll make sure that gets on the podcast.
Yeah.
Push for Better. It's a great cause. Anything that's helping, especially men with mental health.
Yeah.
We can get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then they put money back into other charities like Black Dog, and there's a few.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you mentioned a little bit of a brush with Catholicism, and we have latched onto that to get James to read the wonderful poem that we read to conclude the show almost each week. It was a week that we didn't. So this poem is Jesus at the Gay Bar by Jay Hulme, and it's going to be read by James Parr.
He's here in the midst of it, right at the center of the dance floor. Robes hitched up to kiss his knees to make it easy to spin. At some point in the evening, a boy will touch the hem of his robe and beg to be healed. Beg to be anything other than his, than this. And he will reach his arms out, sweat damp and weary from dance. He'll cup this boy's face in his hand and say, "My beautiful child, there is nothing in this heart of yours that ever needs to be healed."
What do you think about that?
Very beautiful. I could have cried when I read it.
I really wish
earlier.
Yeah.
But I think it's beautiful in so many different ways. Mm. In romance, in love, platonic friendships, in family, Jesus. I think that is relatable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that we often say on the show, it's a really low bar that whoever we are, we just deserve to be accepted for who we are.
Exactly.
That's a really important point. James, it has been a joy having you on the show tonight. Thank you.
See what you did there. Oh, it was a joy being here.
It was a joy. That's great. Thank you. We'll use that for a promo at some point. But no, and I hope the push-up challenge goes really well for you and that gets lots of people
for
on
my
board.
Shoulders. No,
for
your shoulders. It'll be great.
We'll keep that in mind. We are going to finish with a man that we haven't finished with in a while. As I've said that is not a sentence I should say. Troy Saban. Troy, if you're listening, I'm really sorry, sweetie. Thanks for listening, and we'd love you to join us at the Open Table again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Open Table here on Joy. If you missed part of the conversation or want to catch more, find the podcast at joy.org.au/theopentable.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.